Hey, welcome everybody. This is episode 56 of the Book Exchange Podcast. Great to be with you. This is a very special episode of our podcast because it's only been on rare occasions when my co-host and I who are sitting together in the same place. This is a rare opportunity for us to record an episode of the Book Exchange Podcast together, which is a lot of fun. We can, like, you know, look at each other and interact. And, you know, before I go any further, I should actually introduce my co-host, whose house I'm sitting in, so that would be probably proper. And I'm sitting here with my co-host, John Lovell, here in Easton, Maryland. John, why don't you ring in?
Hey there, everybody. Glad to be back with you here. It's been, I guess, about 3 weeks. We try to do this every 2 weeks, but lately, in the reboot phase here, it seems like it's coming out every 3 weeks, but we'll just do the best that we can.
Yeah.
To keep it as regular as possible. But yeah, great to be here with you in the room. And I think we got a really cool episode and lots of good stuff to discuss right now.
Yeah, we totally do. We've done this once before. It was one episode in the 30s, John. It was the Freedom episode that we did once a few years back around July 4th.
I was thinking about that episode recently, and I'll mention why in a little bit. But that episode floated back into my mind.
Yeah, yeah. So just offline, you know, John and I being family members, we were doing some family stuff this week and we decided to get together at his house just to do some more hanging out and also to do an episode of this podcast. So here we are sitting in the same room. John, I want to thank you publicly for opening up your home and letting us do a podcast.
Glad to do it. I'm glad you could make it. And thanks for the sacrifice of your family to have you here.
Yeah, yeah. No, I am thankful to my family also. So let's get to what we're going to be talking about today. This is, again, episode 56. And it's going to be special for another reason because we teased it last time, we just passed on the calendar, like the holiday, if you will, in the United States that's called Father's Day. So we thought that presented a good opportunity for us to make this episode, which we've finally settled on a title, which is Fathers in Literature. Do I have that right? Fathers in Literature?
You do. And, yeah. You know, we tried to get our act together and release this closer to the actual Father's Day. But as I was just saying, you know, things intervene.
Right.
So this is as close as we could get. But that has no impact on how compelling a topic it is.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, this obviously is a really rich one. So listeners of our show know that John and I both have 4 children. So we have large families of our own. We're from a big family. Listeners also know that we lost our dad almost 9 years ago. So we've had a lot of rich exchange with an ex on the show about our dad and his influence on us as readers and kind of, you know, people that seek information and stuff. So our dad is, you know, on our mind a lot, and he's definitely on our mind when we talk about the subject of fatherhood. But we also, sure, John, have all these decades of reading, and we, you know, you come across many, many stories and nonfiction books where there are memorable fathers in one way or another, which leads me to a point I want to make, and then I'll let you kind of elaborate on it. So we're going to be talking today about fathers, both in fiction and nonfiction, as I just got to, and also good fathers and maybe not as good fathers, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And I just a quick point to make, you, this is probably in your mind, as you said, like, our dad is certainly hovering over this conversation, but, you know, in terms of our own father, you're talking about somebody who wrote an epic 2-poem cycle about fatherhood.
Yeah, that's right.
Called The Geography of Fatherhood.
That's right, yeah.
And they were both long poems about his own childhood and sort of his relationship with his father and the mystery of the relationship between fathers and sons, which is a topic that we will definitely come back to in this episode.
Yeah, yeah, fathers and sons for sure. We're also going to be touching on fathers and daughters. And like I alluded to before, we're going to be touching on some, for me, like very memorable fathers in literature that weren't very good fathers. So we're going to talk about some of those figures as well.
Same here.
Either way, John, I think we can agree, and it's sort of self-evident and kind of obvious, but, you know, fathers are greatly influential figures in, you know, almost everybody's life, you know, one way or another, rather by their presence or by their absence.
No question.
We've had ample opportunities in our lives as fathers and sons to ponder our influence and the influence of our dad on us and, you know, what we do right and what we do wrong and all of these factors. It's such a giant topic, but they come into play when you think about fathers and literature. So we're going to be, again, as listeners of our show know, we read pretty widely and we both have different reading interests. And when we sort of separate, John, to come up with lists for an episode like this and come back, we usually come back with, you know, a few things that overlap just because of us being twins. But then we do bring in very different stuff. So we're going to be kind of, once again, just like we did with our episode on Australia or books we're reading lately or anything like that, we're going all over the place, you know, on this one. So that's one of the things I'm excited about is that we both made lists. They're zagging all over the map. So that's just kind of par for the course.
Yeah, it's like that every time. And but it's one of the, we think, one of the fun aspects of this show. So yeah, I'm ready to dive in if you are. Although we have some preliminary stuff that we
I'm ready too. We'll follow the format. So let's have a brief discussion now about the books that we're reading currently, and then we'll dive in. And then you know, we'll follow the format at the end. We'll talk about books that are coming up, and then we'll tease the next episode. So John, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so I'm going to kick it to you to tell us about what it is that you're reading right now. I see it there in front of you.
That's right.
Massive weight there. Why don't you share it with us?
Well, I'm excited to do that here in your presence because you gave me this book.
That's right.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure I brought up, you brought up, the episode on freedom that we did together in this very room the last time we were podcasting in this very room together. And I'm 99% sure that the name Frederick Douglass would have come up in that discussion.
Yeah.
I think we talked about his first narrative or autobiography. I don't remember the exact title, but it's an autobiography. He wrote three. But the first one is really the best known. And so Frederick Douglass is a figure from American history I've been interested in for some time. One of the reasons that I'm interested in him is because he was born, as we said on that episode that we recorded here, born about 10-15 minutes from where I'm sitting. And he spent a lot of his early life right here in Talbot County, Maryland. And I'm learning that some of the locations where he was held as a slave are quite close to this very house. So
it's wild.
Anyway, I'm reading a big, thick biography that came out about him in the last couple of years. Won the Pulitzer Prize. It was a big, big book, you know, in the world of history. And it's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David W. Blight.
Is that Freedom again?
Yeah, so that's, you know, he's certainly Prophet of Freedom. He certainly, and I think appropriately, came up in our discussion about freedom and his autobiography. We talked about that a little bit in that episode. But, you know, in this one, that's the book I'm reading now. I'm only in the very, as you can see, I'm in the very early stages, less than 100 pages in.
Yeah.
And this is a mighty book. You know,
we're
slamming on the
your
desk here. So I hope you heard that. Like, yeah. It's a big, thick book. I think it's going to be really interesting. Frederick Douglass, as I said, wrote these three autobiographical accounts of his life as a slave and kind of, you know, rising past that. And as most people know, you know, he was very bright. He was, he kind of taught himself how to read and write, although I've learned that he had a lot of, you know, influential figures along the way who helped him with that.
Hmm.
But he ended up becoming a great statesman for the United States, an incredible orator, which is amazing because you're talking about virtually no education, except for self-education
and the will.
And the will and some influence by the church. But he became an incredible orator, became a statesman. He became an ambassador. You know, he's just a very, very prominent figure in Washington and on the American scene for many, many years. And then what's going to be really interesting about this book is that in the introduction he describes that there's not a lot out there that gets into the last third of his life when he was a diplomat and he was ambassador to Haiti. And kind of how he interacted with different U.S. presidents during that time. So I think that's sort of a lesser known aspect. You know, the parts of his life where he is a slave and where he, you know, sort of figuratively and literally breaks the bounds of slavery, and you know finds his calling as a you know diplomat and statesman, I think it's pretty well known. But that last third is not as well known, so it's going to be really interesting to get the full picture of his life. So I'm really looking forward to you know digging into this more. I think it's going to take me quite a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I'm reading now. Anybody interested in Frederick Douglass? I mean, this would seem to be a no-brainer. So,
well, that looks really cool, and you and I both kind of enjoy. I think, like, we're not intimidated by huge nonfiction or history or biographies like that. Like, I find that like a really interesting thing to do is take a really deep dive on somebody like that who's has to be a figure that's like. Really sort of merits that much time and effort, but Frederick Douglass is certainly that guy, you know?
Yeah.
You remember that, and this is just a side note, you remember that scene in Glory, the movie Glory with Matthew Broderick, where it's early in the movie, he's at like a cocktail party or something like that, and he's just hobnobbing with people, and somebody says, have you met Frederick Douglass?
Oh, I forgot about that part.
And there, and you know, it's been a while since I've seen it, but and I have no idea who the actor was. But even the presence in the movie, they got like an actor. He's this big, imposing figure with like a suit on, big beard, you know, kind of like really striking, dark-skinned man. And even in the movie, in that scene in the movie, I think he might have like one line or something, but he was like a presence.
Yeah, the authority.
And that's kind of like the way that I picture Frederick Douglass. So, and I remember when we did the Freedom episode, you already knew a lot about Frederick Douglass because of, like, you live around here, and you had been to, you know, a few of the sites and stuff. You had read his autobiography, which I never have, you know.
It's an American classic.
Which is definitely an oversight. And so you already knew kind of a lot about him. But you happen to know, just offside question, do you know, like, how long he lived? And did he die of, like, natural causes? Or he certainly wasn't, like, assassinated or something.
No, like, no, he was not, as far as I know of. I don't really know how he died, but I believe it was natural causes.
You're going to find out, I guess.
Yeah, I guess, when I get... But he lived and served for quite a long time. I don't remember exactly when, but late into the 19th century.
Well, yeah, it's quite a life. Well...
But I was just at, and then we'll move on to what you're reading, but I was just reading, you know, like, there's our county courthouse... is about 5 minutes away from here. And I pass it all the time. And I'm very familiar with it. And I was just reading a passage where I did not realize, I probably should have, that that courthouse has been there for a long time. There's a jail around the back, which is still there. In that jail, Frederick Douglass was held for several weeks while he was, they were contemplating selling him. He got in trouble because he tried to escape from a plantation around here. With three other slaves. Wow. He organized the escape. He was a young man. The other three were let go. But he was held in prison. Right here at this courthouse around the back. And they describe his ordeal there. And it's just interesting to note. Because for several weeks he was... And prospective owners would come by. And they'd like reach through the bars. And like kind of feel the body of the slave. To see if they were hardy or strong.
Yeah,
and what's the word I'm looking for? The opposite of dignity, you know, like what they go through.
Indignity.
Thank you. Like the indignity of being in that position, literally
yeah.
like felt up to see if you're worthy,
right.
like a piece of meat. And yet now there's this beautiful and triumphant statue of Frederick Douglass right outside our courthouse that we pass every day here. It's magnificent. And it's just that journey. You know, that's the whole journey right there.
Yeah, right.
Now he's honored in a very proud way. Anyway, that's like a whole other episode. But great book. Thank you for giving it to me. And that's that. What are you reading right now?
And I own a copy of that book myself, so I got to fit it in, too. We should also swing by and see that statue while I'm here, because I don't remember if I've ever seen that.
But anyway, can do it. It's very close.
Anyway, so I'm reading a book that you're also familiar with, John, because you didn't... Well, you did give it to me. I borrowed your copy. But you were the guy that read it first. So I'm reading a book. It's tough to describe this book. Remember last time, last episode, I struggled to find the name of the little side project I was doing with my own reading called The Triple Deuce, where I was reading the second three books that were second books in a trilogy. This one that I'm reading is the last of those three. So I read...
So this is the last of the Triple Deuce.
Right. So I read...
try to keep up, folks.
The last one that I read was Dune Messiah, you know, like the continuing the Dune saga of Frank Herbert. Now I'm reading a book that's called The Cold 6000, and it's part of a crime trilogy, I guess I would say, written by a very well-known and prominent American crime writer, fiction writer named James Ellroy. Best known for writing the novel that the movie L.A. Confidential is based on from the late 90s with Kim Basinger and Guy Pearce and the young Russell Crowe. He's famous for other crime novels like The White... is it The Black Dahlia?
The Black Dahlia. Black Dahlia. That's another movie.
White Jazz is another one that he wrote. And a well-known memoir that he wrote about his own kind of troubled childhood was called My Dark Places. You know, James Ellroy. And he's written this trilogy. I don't think the trilogy has a name. It's about the 1960s, basically. And the jacket copy on the back of this second volume that I'm reading now, called The Cold 6000, says that he, in this trilogy, he lights a pipe bomb and stuffs it underneath the 1960s and just blows it all to hell.
Yeah.
You know, like, and these books beg for descriptions like that. They're very hard to describe. I read the first, you gifted me in The Exchange with the X, the first volume, which was published in 1995, is called American Tabloid. It's about 600 or 700 pages long. All three of them are. You had read The Cold 6000. You hadn't even read American Tabloid. But then you figured out that it was part of a trilogy, and you were like, I'm going to basically introduce you to this trilogy by James Ellroy.
Right.
I just read the second volume, and it's bananas. And I was like, oh, cool, you know, crime trilogy, you know, how bananas can it be? Well, it is totally bananas for, like, many reasons. I got to tell you, John, I'm not, like, I read American, well, let me continue with my intro to it before I get to that point. But I read American Tabloid. It became my number one book of the year, because we do the book list at the end of the year. I was just starting to say, I am not generally that interested in the 1960s. Historical period. These books are all about the Kennedys, you know, RFK, JFK, the Kennedy assassination, you know, the Bay of Pigs towards the end of the 50s. No, in the
early
60s, sorry. But the Castro Revolution towards the end of the 50s. Obviously, the assassination, the civil rights movement, which is interesting to me, but I'm no expert on it. RFK and his, like, presidential run, that terrible summer of 1968. None of that stuff has ever interested me terribly. You know, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, Howard Hughes, all this kind of stuff that's been depicted in movies. But obviously everybody knows it's this tumultuous period in American history. But these three books are about those years. And basically, John, it's about, maybe you can help me to flesh this out, but it's all three books are about that decade, but if I describe it, I'd say it's all the underbelly. So it's about the...
Definitely.
Corruption, scheming, drugs, racism...
prostitution.
Dirty cops, everything, like deals being made by, like, the Kennedys and the government, conspiracy.
And the press, too.
It's all about all that stuff. And your word to describe James Ellroy writing these books is totally uncompromising. So, and furthermore, the other thing that's interesting about this series is that they're written in a way that the best way I can describe it, it's like as if this guy, James Ellroy, like decided to probe the underbelly, but he did it on like a huge cocktail of uppers, you know, or like speed or something.
Yeah.
You know, because they're written in this like staccato manner. They have very short chapters, but they run for like 600-700 pages each of these novels. That I would say something like 70% of the sentences in these books are like three or four words. It's like, you know,
it's like
Wayne ran in, Wayne popped his gun, the girl screamed, Wayne read it, you know, and it's just like da-da-da for 700 pages.
The smoke curled.
The smoke curled. And it'll do stuff like, you know, the, you know, he'll use like horrible language. I'll just say the black man, but he might use a different word. The black man stooped way, and they'll have like a low, you know, stuff like that. And it's just written in this like staccato manner. And there's something like very intoxicating and like insane about it. Not to mention the fact that it's also very dark, very scuzzy. Like, you know, there's tons of sex in the books. There's tons of corruption. There's tons of deals. There's horrible language. You know, there's drug use. There's murder. You know, and you get the overall effect of, so I'm admit, you know, reading the second book. And then I actually own the third book, which is called Blood's a Rover, which is an interesting title. Blood's a Rover. Mm-hmm. But between the three of them, you know, I described it, and then I'll stop. I'll let you comment on it because you read The Cold 6000. Like, I described it to you earlier this week as, like, you know, when you read these books, I don't even know if I could say that I really, I am very impressed with them, but it's not something you, like, really like. It's like sitting in the front car of a, like, crappy 100-year-old, you know, roller coaster.
Wooden.
It's like going downhill, and you're like leaning back like this. They can't, you know, listeners can't see us, but you're like, your teeth are open, and like your hair is going back, and it's going too fast, and you have no idea if you're going to like crash or burn or like survive.
Right. You hope you're still safe by the end.
Yeah, and that's what reading these books is like. It's literally like that, which I find very impressive from a literary point of view as somebody who writes fiction. I'm like, okay, these aren't the funnest books to read. But they're insane. There are three of them, and they go on for like a grand total of like 2,000 pages. How does somebody do that? Like, what do you remember about The Cold 6000?
I mean, that's the reason why I gave you the first book, because there's some, you know, you read it. Reading one of Elroy's books is like, it's an experience. And I know this is the worst of cliches, but you really feel like you have to take about 6 showers after you've read his books, but
or even a chapter.
The prose, like the prose is like, it's like machine gun fire or like fireworks going off, just like rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat. and it just, you're just like, because the sentences are so short, you just kind of fly through, and it's like that wild ride you described. Not only are you on that roller coaster, but you're going through like tunnels of muck.
Substrata.
It's all being like flung at your face and your, you know, but. Yeah, but I don't know. There's something really kind of exhilarating about it, and also totally unique.
Good word for it, yeah.
It's totally unique.
A good word, too. It is kind of exhilarating. And again, as somebody who writes fiction, I'm like, how the hell did this guy do this? But then you think about what state of mind you have to be in to go that deep into even a historical era, let alone the underbelly and corruption under it, and then execute it on the page. You know?
It's not good.
I mean, yeah, you gotta have something going on with you to begin with to even write these books.
But then again, you're talking about, like you mentioned before, you're talking about somebody who was born and raised in L.A., and his mother was the murder victim in that Black Dahlia case.
Yes,
so his mother was like, brutally murdered.
Yes.
And he investigated that case for a long time. So he kind of grew up in the midst of this kind of corruption and sleaze and violence. And so it's just a part of him, and he's just like, it's like an exorcism or something. He's just barfing it all out. But anyway, it's really, anybody who enjoys reading crime fiction, you got to read at least one James Elroy.
Yeah. I think that's
just for the experience, but it's a little bit like, and we'll stop, but it's a little bit like, last week we were talking about, or last time we recorded, we were talking about Richard Flanagan and Gould's Book of Fish. And one of the things you said is like, just never read anything like it.
Yeah, and that's what it is. Yeah.
This exchange, when either of us, with all the reading that we've done, we read something that's like nothing else we've encountered, you almost give it automatically as a gift to the other guy and just say, you got it. I never experienced anything like this.
Yeah, you got to read this.
So that's literally why I gave you the Elroy. That's kind of the only reason. It's like, I've never read anything like this before. And so that's it.
And when I was thinking of the second volume, with this triple deuce concept, I thought, well, this is a good chance for me to go back and read that second book in Elroy. But there have been many years between me reading American Tabloid, which is probably by design, because they're exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know a lot of people that would, I can think of several listeners of this show who would not come anywhere near a book like this. I was even trying to explain it to my family members when I was on vacation. They're like, what are you reading? And I'm like, well, you know, this is like the dingy underbelly of a wild ride, you know, on like speed or whatever. They're like, man, you're weird. But like, again, it's like with movies with us, and we can move on. Like, you know, when we see something that the that we just never seen before, we immediately tell one another, because it's like, you got to watch this.
You got to watch it.
Like that. So anyway, anyway, good talk there on the books we're reading. That's the one I'm reading, and so now we can turn kind of to our main subject. Do we need a break yet, or do you want to just kind of hop right into it?
I say hop right in.
Okay, so we're going to now turn our discussion to fathers in literature. Okay, and while John takes care of a little logistical business here, it's such a broad topic, and we already explained kind of like where we're coming from, at least sort of on the subject of dads in literature and what our perspectives are and stuff. We're about to dip into just the smallest sampling, really, because you could go in so many different directions, and I imagine that some people who listen to this might be like, well, why didn't you talk about this book or this book? By the way, feel free to contact us and let us know if there's stuff that we missed on this topic or any topic, you know, through our email address, bookexchangetwins@gmail.com, exchange with an X. Let us know if we missed something that you thought was essential. But I think for the purposes of discussing fathers in literature, John, I'm going to start off, if you don't mind, in like kind of a smallish way, if we don't go on too long about this. Both of us, as we indicated before, took it in many different directions. But for the first, you know, part of the discussion here, there were two sort of smaller works from like historical works of fiction that I knew I wanted to bring up in some manner. You know, they don't merit like a really long discussion, although you could go on at length about any of them. But there are two stories that came to my mind. One is kind of a novella and one is a short story that's only like, it's like less than 20 pages, with fathers that are kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, there's one with a really virtuous and a good father, to me, is an example of like a shining paternity figure in literature, however minor he might be to the story.
Okay.
And in the other story, the father is like a bad influence and a rather mysterious one. But both have been, I've encountered them in my reading over many years more than once in each case, and they've definitely stood out to me. So I'll start there. So I'll talk about the virtuous father first, because I don't see how you can do a discussion of fathers in literature without bringing up a very famous dad, which is Bob Cratchit in Charles Dickens' classic, A Christmas Carol. And Bob Cratchit, as you know, so, you know, most readers are familiar or listeners are familiar of the story of A Christmas Carol because of all the film versions and the shows, but you know, there's the character of Bob Cratchit is famously Ebenezer Scrooge's employee at his place of work that he treats very badly. And he's very respectful and good and loyal worker who does kind of everything that Scrooge kind of like asks him to do and then some, and gets kind of pushed around sort of emotionally. You'd call him emotionally abusive today, Ebenezer Scrooge, of his employee.
Yeah.
Gets pushed around by Scrooge all the time and ridiculed and like put down and whatever. And as the story shows, Bob Cratchit goes home to his large family he gets paid very little by the miserly Scrooge. He's got almost no money. They're kind of poor, you know, a very Dickensian father figure, you know, reminiscent of Dickens' own father who has struggled with poverty and debt and stuff like that. But Bob Cratchit goes home, and there's the famous part of the Christmas Carol where he goes home and he has the Christmas meal, and he proposes a toast to Ebenezer Scrooge, who's his employer, and his wife is very like, she goes along with him because she's, you know, sort of subservient in a wifely way that was common to the, you know, older times. So she agrees to do the toast, but she obviously does not want to toast Ebenezer Scrooge because of how badly he pays and treats Bob Cratchit. And then they have the handicapped child, Tiny Tim, who famously says, you know, God bless us, everyone, at the end of the story. But, you know, in one version of events, because there's you know, obviously time travel with the three spirits in A Christmas Carol, you know, Tiny Tim doesn't make it, and he ends up as kind of like an empty chair at the table. But what I just wanted to say about Bob Cratchit is he has always stood out to me as, you know, the quintessential father, and you and I can relate to this so much, who's like doing what he's got to do to take care of his family, you know, and going home and trying to be respectful of the people that pay him his wages. Also be respectful of God. He's like a Christian man, and he's essentially telling his family that they should count their blessings and not bemoan their station, you know, or like knock on, you know, people who are in better circumstances. And then he shows a lot of love and affection to all his wife and children in the story of Christmas Carol. So I'll leave it there with Bob Cratchit, you know, like, but to me, he's like an essential kind of literary dad that, you know, had to be mentioned. Now, do you want to comment on that, or should I bring up the other story?
I'll just comment briefly on it, and then you can. Okay. But just to say that that's a wonderful pick for to kick things off, because it's a very famous character, but like, it didn't pop up into my, it makes sense because you're such a Dickens fan that it popped up into your head immediately. It didn't come to mind for me immediately, but like, just he's memorable because they are so destitute and they don't have much, and he's so put upon and abused, but he maintains somehow a positive spirit, and in that, in doing that, he is a slow, quiet, steady leader for his family, and by extension, everybody who reads the book, it's like you don't need to have much in terms of possession or anything really, but you can still be that steady hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Bob Cratchit is through the story. And then by the end of the story, that kind of like witness or example that he sets has kind of a profound impact on things, you know, like, yeah. In some ways, I know it's the ghosts and the spirits that sort of like cause this quote unquote conversion for Scrooge, but he recognizes the virtues in Bob Cratchit. So
right.
It's just great that you picked that, because it starts things off on kind of a, you know, this sounds highfalutin, but like a sort of a virtuous note, and like what a father can be, even though the circumstances can be very, very challenging.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a great pick. That's all.
Yeah, those are good comments. Yeah, like just like somebody who's almost, his behavior is kind of Christ-like. He's continually turning the other cheek towards his oppressors as a way to set that example for the people that are around him.
Right.
You know, and sort of live out his values and his faith.
Right. You don't need to have a lot of material. You don't need to be wealthy. You don't need to have a lot to be a good father. And Bob right. Cratchit is a great example of that. So anyway.
Right.
That's a good, I like the way that starts things off.
Well, thanks. And then on the other side of that.
Flip the coin over.
I've always just had this particular literary father in my mind, even though it's from only an 18 or 19 page short story from, I believe, the early 20th century. And the story is written by Franz Kafka, who's a figure that we could discuss at great length, perhaps in another episode.
Yeah.
But one of the most famous short fiction writers in the history of literature in English, who wrote very dark stories with enigmatic subject matter, troubling situations and scenes. You know, he's famous for his novel The Trial. We've talked about it in another episode. The Castle is another one of his novels, and kind of America with a K was his first novel, but he's also very famous for his short stories. Everything that he wrote, of course, was famously published after he died, because his best friend who had read his work ignored his wishes, because Franz Kafka wanted everything to be burned. You know, and his friends ignored his wishes and published everything, including all of his many short stories, which are very dark and enigmatic and often very mysterious. But one of the most famous Franz Kafka short stories, and one of the earliest stories that he wrote, was reflective of what is famously known about him now, which was that he had a very difficult relationship with his own father, who was not absent, but just not supportive. And it was something that tormented Franz Kafka throughout his short life, which only went about 40 years. And the story, The Judgment, one of his earliest stories, is reflective of that. And it's a very strange, I just reread it this morning, thanks to you for having a copy on your shelf. Very strange Anytime. Tale about, because I remember, you and I have always joked about the end of this story.
Right.
But I remember at the very end of it, which I'll bring up, but I didn't remember the rest of it. It's just about this guy, young guy, sort of like a Franz Kafka figure in Europe who's starting out in life. In the beginning, is just sitting in a room writing a letter to this guy who he never identifies by name. You know, just typical of Kafka. A friend who lives in St. Petersburg, out of some distance away, that he's writing to. And he's trying to figure out if he wants to let this friend know that he's become engaged to a woman. And he's debating whether to pass this information on the letter because it might change the tenor of their friendship, you know.
Yeah.
And they haven't seen each other in many years. So he finally decides to tell the friend that he's getting married. He sends the letter off. And then he goes into his apartment where he lives with this domineering and very bitter, strange father. And he basically reports to him that he's written a letter. He's like, "Dad, you know, just to let you know, I've written a letter to my friend in St. Petersburg that you and I have discussed many times." But they never say the guy's name. They let him know that I'm getting engaged. You know, "I just wanted to let you know that I'm telling him that." And then the father begins to talk to them about why he did that. And the conversation kind of turns, and suddenly it becomes sort of like antagonistic. And towards the end of the story, there's some spoilers here, the father is kind of on this guy's case for telling his friend about getting engaged. And the father starts ridiculing him. And the father is also the son's employer. You know, and he's like running a business, and the business is right. Like, you know, and he's very kind of like Ebenezer Scrooge-ish towards the son. And then as it goes on, he begins to kind of ridicule him and, you know, tell him how much he doesn't understand and doesn't know. And he's like, "You don't know anything about the business. The business is much more profitable than you think. I don't trust you with anything. I'm doing things on the side." And as this is going on, the father is kind of sitting under a blanket and kind of bundled up, and it's like, and the son is kind of doing like caregiving to him, like he's moving him from the chair to the bed and kind of putting a blanket on him, and the father gets more and more like antagonistic, you know, and he's talking to him, and finally the father just says, "In fact, you don't even know, I've been writing to your friend in Petersburg all along, and I've been telling him stuff about your failures and things that you can't do right. The whole time, and you don't even know that me and him have this strong relationship. You have no idea what the hell is going on." And it continues like that. And then towards the end of the story, you know, now I just read it this morning. I can't remember exactly why. But it continues in that vein. And the son is all starting to get all flustered. And then the father says, "You know, in fact, because of all these things, you know, like, it occurs to me that you're basically a miserable person. You know, and I, as a result of that, I sentence you to death by drowning." So, like, and it just takes this real dark turn, and the son is, like, totally flummoxed. And he runs out onto the street, he finds the nearest bridge, and he jumps off. And that's the end of the story. And I remember you and I joking about this story, because we were
both
getting interested in Franz Kafka. And because his stories are so mysterious and dark, and he has many other dark and mysterious stories that have a totally different quality. Like, remember the story, The Burrow, about the guy reporting about this burrow he's constructing underground. You know, it's a totally different...
Vaguely. Or The Penal Colony.
In The Penal Colony, which is like another story by him. And there were endless layers of dark, brooding fascination to Franz Kafka's work that are what's worth exploring. It's like, why was he like this? Why, you know, why was he filled with all these different anxieties? Why were his stories so dark and strange? And that, to me, is the quintessential example of it in a way. But also, when we thought of fathers in literature, and I'll kick it over to you, that was one of the first things that came to my mind. Remember that father busting, ridiculing his son and then sentencing him to die? And the son being so, like, distraught over that he immediately ran out and executed the sentence on himself.
Yeah.
You know, and what does that say? So that's the opposite end of it. Do you have any thoughts on Kafka or The Judgment or like that story? Because you and I joke about it all the time. I say to you, "By the way, I sent you to death by drowning.
Yeah.
Go find the nearest bridge."
It's just such a absurd and like the dark, blackest way ending.
Yeah.
I don't recall much about the story other than that very ending because I doubt I would forget it anyway, and B, because we joke about it all the time. But
yeah,
certainly, you know, as some kind of like parable almost, or
or fairy tale that to reflect the psychological realities or complications of his own relationship with his father. You know, you don't have to be Sigmund Freud to realize that there must be a lot of damage and, you know, just bad juju, you know.
Bad blood.
Roiling under the surface that he's sort of working out in that story. You know, like a lot of Kafka stories, it's like heightened and exaggerated and like, not mythic, but, you know, it's like absurd, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't bear much of a resemblance to actual reality, but it has so much power on the page.
Right, just like with In the Penal Colony, I don't remember much about that, but I do remember that whatever your sins are, there's this incredible contraption that somehow carves what your sin is into your belly.
Yeah.
In this prison, you know. So it's like, you know, obvious, or like the metamorphosis, obviously, you know, turning into this giant bug, you know.
Yes, yeah, the metamorphosis, thank you. I couldn't think of that before.
Yeah, the most famous story, you know. Yeah. But this one is just, it's a good one to bring up because it's just one of the darkest portraits, you know, or portrayals of a relationship between a father and son that you'll ever.
Yeah, it's called The Judgment.
You know, and it's like 12 pages or something.
Yeah, and again,
yeah, like The Judgment, right.
Like with Elroy, it's like you, this is not for everybody, but like you sort of wonder about what is going on in the person that created this fiction, you know, that could have led to the creation like this. And that, if you follow it a certain way, can get you to thinking about the figure of the father in Franz Kafka's life and, like, you know, what can happen when a father is a highly judgmental or critical figure, you know, and you read it and you think about your own capacities to be critical or judgmental.
Right.
And, you know, what kind of damage you can do by that.
Right, right. And obviously that kind of, like, the father's influence can be lasting both in a positive and a negative sense. Like, I think in Dad's poems that I referred to earlier, you know, our grandfather's all over that, but the negative parts of his influence are you can't miss them.
No.
In a lot of what he wrote about. So this story is like that, but just sort of writ large.
Yeah, and those negative pieces were prominent in any story about Dad's dad throughout his entire life.
Right, right.
You know, they were always there. But anyway, we've been going on. I'm going to move it over to you. Let's have you bring up some fathers in literature that we can boot around.
Yeah, I'm going to bring up, I mean, there are many, like, classic examples that I think many, many readers would bring up, and I'm going to bring up some of those, just some of them maybe in passing, but you can't talk about this topic without mentioning them. One of the most famous, and I'm definitely not going to talk about this one at length because it's been so long since I read it, but most people, either through the film or the book, one of the most famous fathers in literature that might pop to mind is Atticus Finch. In To Kill a Mockingbird. Again, haven't read it in a long time, but anybody who does read that book even once, or certainly who sees the movie with the, you know, the classic portrayal by Gregory Peck, and it was recently revived on the stage, and it's still going around, I think, but Jeff Daniels played him on stage for a long time in New York, and a little trivia, he did not miss a single performance in like a year and a half run. But anyway, he's one of the most lasting father figures, and he's just, I don't remember why. There are many people out there, including listeners, who will know more about this book than me, but he's a single father. I guess his wife died. I don't remember the circumstances around that. He's just one of the quintessential examples of, like, a positive, strong, virtuous example, especially for children, because the point of view of that book, obviously, is from a young girl. And there's her brother and their friends, and they're all, they look at Atticus throughout the whole book. There's this sense of, like, awe and kind of wonder and a little bit of mystery, which is something that's going to come up again and again. Kind of from a child's point of view, the mystery of the father.
Mm-hmm.
What goes on in that guy's head?
Yeah.
What does he have to deal with?
Yeah.
You know, how does he deal with it? And, you
Can
know,
I
how
rescue him from whatever's bothering
him? Yeah, or it's just sometimes it his stress has come back on you.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
The slings and arrows.
Guilty.
Etc. You know. Oh, same here. Yeah. So, that's just, I mentioned that one in passing because that's, I mean, even though I only read the book once, Atticus Finch is one of the things you remember most about that book. And he's this interesting combination of, like, he relates to children very well. but he also is one of the few people in the town who defends the African-American, you know, townspeople, and it, of course, the trial, and, you know, all of that. So
all I can say about that, by the way, I'm interrupting and let you move on, is that I wouldn't know because, incredibly, I just amazed some of our nieces and nephews this week by saying this. I have never read To Kill a Mockingbird or seen the movie.
Oh, my gosh.
So you talk about a glaring oversight in that. So I don't know what Atticus Finch is like. I just don't know how to forget.
Sorry, folks.
I was wondering why you didn't jump in with
I
more.
I think I've just, the intern has handed me a note and I just got fired from the show.
You know what? You're condemned to jump off the nearest
bridge. Yeah, I sent you to death by drowning.
No, I did know that about you. I think it may have even come up in this show before, but that really, that's incredible.
I've never read a word of it.
It's incredible with the amount that you read, but it's also incredible because it's, as everyone knows, it's like a staple in every single curriculum you could possibly come across. It's always read in school. All my kids read it.
So did mine. I'm taking your word.
But as you said, you didn't bother to read any of your assignments.
And this is the proof, you know.
Anyway, To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm not the expert on that one, but it has to be mentioned. And there's some other, like, just famous fathers in literature that, you know, just have to come up. I'm going to focus on two of them, but another one I'm going to bring up because I have to. And you and I, unfortunately, we won't have a lot of time to talk about this one, but you and I both brought it up, and that is, the novel is Pinocchio by Carlo Collodi.
Yes.
And the father figure there, is Geppetto.
Right.
Puppet maker.
Right.
And anyone who's, if you've seen the recent stop motion animation film on Netflix made by Guillermo del Toro, that he really adheres closely to the novel. The novel's very, very different than the Disney, than the popular Disney animated film, which is, you know, a lot of us grew up knowing that movie and that's how we knew the Pinocchio story, but we both went back later and read the original novel. It's a very different vibe.
Very different.
But the fatherhood theme, the theme of paternity, the theme of caring for your young ones, the theme of worrying about how your quote-unquote children are going to turn out.
Losing a child. Yeah.
Which happens in more ways than one in Pinocchio. Yeah. You know, obviously, one of the reasons Geppetto carves the young boy out of wood is because he loses his actual son. And then, of course, the wooden puppet comes to life. And kind of throughout the course of the, I actually don't remember how the original novel ends. I think it's a lot darker.
I think it is too, but my memory is so bad. But yeah.
But certainly in the Disney version, you know, he kind of like earns his father's love, you know.
Yeah.
And I think in the Del Toro, the recent Netflix movie, he sort of earns his father's love too.
Yeah,
but it also has a kind of a tragic ending.
Yes.
In a weird way, that's one of the most famous and interesting books on fatherhood. It's like we're going to come at fatherhood from a lot of angles in this show, and I'm going to bring up another one in just a minute. But Pinocchio, and it's funny because the author of Pinocchio, not only was he not a believer, so he didn't believe in, like, God's paternity over all of mankind, but he also hated children.
Yeah.
So he didn't care for children either, and this is well known. But yet, curiously, you know, the love for a father for a son, and it's not only sons in this episode, by the way, but Pinocchio happens to be about a father and sons. And also, that comes through very clearly through the book, which is strange. And also, at least questions of, you know, circling around, you know, God's fatherhood over all of us and God's providence are very much in that story.
Yeah, you remember the part from the book and definitely from the movie, but there's a part where Geppetto goes to church and Pinocchio wanders in there because he wants to know what that's all about.
Yeah.
And he disrupts the service and he gets thrown out of the service. But on the way out, he's kind of like, you know, look at that figure up on your stage up there or whatever that is. And it's a cruciform figure in wood. And he's like, he's wood and you're treating him like Everybody loves
he's
him.
Got, yeah. And you're throwing me out. Yeah. And like a, so it has a lot of elements like that, you know, in the story. Not necessarily fatherhood, but like, you know, but the, you know, the father-son dynamic, though, is like a, in this in that particular story, that's like the strongest
yeah.
weave of it, you know.
Yeah, and I would certainly, it's definitely a high recommendation on this topic for me. You know, it's
me
just
too.
A, just yeah. a curious and interesting angle on questions around, you know, fatherhood, but the pedo figure is a complicated one, and
very,
and, his,
yeah.
and his relationship with the son he quote unquote creates, and that's sort of the God angle too, like
right. Right.
you know
course.
He's the maker in you know, you know
yeah.
in quotes is just very interesting. So that one had to be mentioned. Now I'm going to mention two others that I want to talk about a little bit, and you can please comment because
yeah, yeah,
you're familiar
going.
With both
yeah.
of these classic stories, and then we'll take a quick break.
Okay.
And then come back. But in this round where I'm talking about classic fathers, there's two that you said there are two that immediately came to mind for you.
Mm-hmm.
And weirdly enough, you had a good example and a not so good one.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened with me.
Okay.
But there are two totally different ones.
Yeah, great.
So I'll start with you started with the positive one. I'll start with the not so great one. And that is one of the most famous fathers in all of literature, which is King Lear.
Yeah.
From the play entitled King Lear,
yeah, right.
William Shakespeare. I think it's safe to say neither of us are experts on Shakespeare by
yeah.
any by
I'm
any
not.
Stretch of the
you.
Imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
But King Lear's got, I mean, when it comes to all-time bad fathers in literature, King Lear's got is right near the
front
top.
Front of the pack, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, and, you know, I can briefly summarize, you know, the plot. We're not going to talk about it a lot or analyze it, God forbid, because, again, we don't.
Yeah.
But it's just one of the most gripping and kind of wrenching portrayals of a father who's, in that case, literally losing his marbles, but is kind of consumed. All the characters are, but the father is sort of consumed by his own greed and avarice
power,
and kind of,
you know, like,
power
yeah.
and also, but deeper than that, I think, you know, I've noticed, I reread it and I watched
you the whole thing ramping up to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good for you.
And, I saw not that long ago, I saw the Amazon Prime has a really cool,
yeah.
modern
the
version of it,
Anthony Hopkins.
Starring Anthony Hopkins,
yeah.
which is well worth a watch if you have any
definitely,
interest at
yeah.
all.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a really kind of cool updated modern version of the play, but what comes through the most in both this reread and certainly in that version on Amazon Prime is his like bitter need, like how much he needs affirmation, how much
yeah.
he needs power, he needs adulation, he needs his daughter's love, but he needs it so much that he, you know, it's the classic, like, you squeeze them so hard you just squeeze literally the life out of
them dry. I would almost could have used the word lust.
Yeah,
lust after their affection and like worship almost.
Yeah,
like
yeah, that's a great word to use. So,
yeah,
and it's a really interesting look at kind of like the photo negative of what a good father should be.
Yes,
or the results if you squeeze too hard or if you want too much from your children. You know, it's all of that. But you know, just really briefly, most people know. King Lear has three daughters. He's getting up there in years. He realizes, and two of his daughters are married to like dukes or whatever. And so his son-in-law, he's got this kingdom of England and he wants to
divvy it up. Yeah.
So in the beginning he says, you know, he says, I'm going to divide this. And two daughters are married and one is not. One is younger. It's like, I want to divide up what I have and kind of preserve England for the future generations, which is another way of saying, keep hold of my power in my family. But before I do that, you all have to declare how much you love me.
Yes.
And so the first two daughters who are married and a bit older, they have these grand eloquent speeches about how much they love their father. And he's like, I approve. And so you get this third of England and the second one. And you can tell immediately they're trying to one-up each other,
yeah.
you know, in how eloquent they are in their expressions of love for him. And, you know what I'm leading up to. And the second one is like, oh, that's strong effort. So you get this third, and comes to Cordelia, the youngest, and she says, she's like, how much do you love me? And she says, nothing.
And the famous line of response, he's like, what? And he says, nothing comes from nothing. Speak again. Like, you're not going to get shit if you don't give me this affirmation, this public affirmation.
Right.
And she doesn't do it, so she's banished. And she,
King Lear says nothing comes from nothing.
King Lear says...
Not Cordelia.
No, you know, she says nothing. The famous line is like, I love you to the extent of my obligation to do so, no more, no less.
Yeah, right.
Or my relation to you requires. But anyway... It's
Florence Pugh in the Amazon.
In the new one, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, so anyway, she goes into exile. The two sisters immediately start to... You know, connive behind the scenes to basically, our old man is getting too old. He's senile. We need to grab power from him. Let's work together. He gets wind of this. He renounces both of them. And eventually works his way back to Cordelia, who's sent off to France. But she becomes, you know, sort of in cahoots with the King of England, King of France, to kind of, you know, take power back in England. So basically, King Lear and Cordelia kind of reconcile, but King Lear condemns his older two sisters, who are so jealous of one another that one poisons one, and then she kills herself out of guilt. So basically, it's the classic Shakespeare where everybody ends up, the whole stage is littered with dead people. And, you know, King Lear lives long enough to see all three. You know, France invades England, his daughter is killed in that battle. He lives to see all three of them perish, and then he basically dies of grief, and the happy tale is over.
Yeah, right.
But it's just one of the great, again, like we were just saying with some other examples, but like the Kafka story, it's one of the great kind of portrayals of kind of bad fatherhood, but it's also very moving for anyone who, you know, this is a heightened example, but anybody who is an older child who sees their parent kind of aging and maybe even losing their capacities.
Right.
And in this case, they seize that opportunity to stab him in the back, but you could just as easily see how, you know, but Cordelia comes back and is like, oh, father, you know, I love you. I want to care for you. So it's like all those dynamics are at play as well.
It's part of what leads to the great popularity of the show Succession.
You know, because I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I know you're not familiar, but it's like this Lear-like father with three kids, but they have to be mixed genders. But they're all doing the same, you know, like they're wrangling behind him, underneath him, and he's this terrible. He's Lear in like a modern, you know, setting.
Do you know if that's intentional? It must be.
I don't know. It's got to be. You know, it's not all daughters though. But again, it's another story it's a great one. It's a great selection, but it's another story, and I didn't even think of it, so that tells you all I bring to the table. You know, like, there's so many, like, you know, ways you could go, but it's another one that speaks to the influence of fathers.
That's right.
Good or bad, you know, just how much, and it's prominent for all of us, you know, you could talk forever about it with your wife, you could talk forever about it with my wife, you could talk about everybody, you know, our dad, you know, like, our mom's dad, you know, like, just, like, speaks to the tremendous responsibilities that one puts on when they decide, when they become a dad. You know, like...
Absolutely. You know,
yeah.
It's well put. And like we said at the beginning, like, we know many people, I'm sure both of us could name many people who the father is... The positive influence of the father is pervasive and it just carries on. It rings like an echo through the life of...
Yes, you know.
The son or daughter. But by the same time, I know many people who it's the absence of the father that echoes in their life, and they never quite get over that. I can think of a few people, you know, and they sort of carry that with them too. But the level of influence is the same, you know.
That's right.
Like you were just saying. Yeah.
Like, you know, it's just like the consequence, it's just a job, if you will, or a role of great consequence. You know, even if you don't show up the whole time, they're still tremendous.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
And true of mothers, of course, too. But that's another show.
Yeah, that's a different, which, that's a different thing. You know,
someday we should do that show, because that would be a totally different list.
It's a different relationship, obviously. But like.
So I'll mention one more classic really quick.
All right.
And this book is way too long to take a lot of time on. But it's the opposite. You had like a short, you know, like a novella and like a short story. I had a play, which is relatively short. But the next example, which is the positive example I have. One of the most positive father figures in all of literature comes from an absolute titanic, absolute monolith of a book.
Yeah.
And that would be Jean Valjean from mm-hmm. the book and famous musical Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. Way too long. I'm not even going to possibly attempt to summarize it. But I just bring him up because he's one of the first ones that popped in my head, too. Because, and the interesting thing to note with him is that this is not a story of biological fatherhood.
Yeah.
He is right. not in the story of biological father. He's an adoptive father. So,
right. Right. Good point.
A shout out to many adoptive fathers that we know and love. But, you know, the father child bond does not have to be biological in any way.
Point. Yeah, like we have one in our own family.
That's right. But biological, you know, Valjean, most people know, he goes through his life. It's the story of his life. He goes through many twists and turns. He befriends a prostitute. And she dies, and he's with her when she dies, and she asks him to care for her daughter, who's being, he's kind of an indentured slave almost, in, you know, by these two corrupt tavern owners. And he goes and he finds her. And then throughout the rest of the story, he is such a steady rock for this daughter. She grows up under his influence. He cares for her. He worries about her. When she meets a young man and falls in love with him, it's very moving how he takes him. He takes him like his own son. He sacrifices his life, literally, so that the son will survive, so that his daughter can be happy. And at the very end, he, you know, dies in his daughter's presence. And it's just an incredible story. It's very, very long. But, you know, the figure of Valjean is a very human one. So you kind of see all the good and the bad that is, and the, you know, the struggle and the heartache and the success that has gone into forming who he is and make him the father figure that he is for Cosette, who's the adopted father.
And, adopted daughter,
sorry. and he's just one of the greatest of all literary fathers, and just popped into my head, and I felt he had to be mentioned.
Yeah, he's like a character that essentially, like we all do, when we become fathers, whether it's adoptive or through, you know, natural means like you and me. But you sort of affirm or agree, you know, in some way to take on the responsibilities and, like, you know, shoulder them to the best of your ability when you do this. Not everybody does it, but that's what you're doing when you decide you're going to be a father, whether you adopt or whether you're like a... And Valjean is a character who goes to every length.
Right.
Imaginable throughout his entire lifetime, just to remain true to that agreement that he makes, that promise that he makes, that he's going to be the father figure for this girl Cosette, and he just keeps it in front of him like the Star of David or whatever, you know, like the beacon, and he just the North Star. Yeah,
the star. Different star,
not the Star of David. Sorry.
Some but people like, may be guided by the star.
A beacon, David, you know, like, like, you know, like he refuses to let go of that commitment that he made. No, come what may. And he follows it all the way to the very end.
That's right.
That's Jean Valjean.
And that's what you take away from it, too. Although it's worth noting that, and I think he says this in the story, like, because he's in his life, he's, you know, he's in prison and he becomes very successful. He owns successful businesses. He becomes mayor. You know, he becomes a wealthy man and a successful one, a self-made. Right. But, you know, I think he says that, you know, it wasn't when I had a daughter, I realized what was really important, just like all of us who have children.
Right.
They, like, have this tendency to really focus and teach you what is really important in life and what isn't.
Right.
And that relationship in Les Miserables is, you know, that's another, it's not a lesson, but just that's another prominent theme that comes from reading that book or seeing the play.
So, right.
So we'll take a quick pause and we'll come back and, you know, we've got plenty more titles to talk about. Sorry, you're supposed to be leading this show. So. Yeah, all right.
Who cares?
Be right back.
All right, so we're back. Good discussion going here, John. So I'm just going to move on with a couple other titles that I wanted to bring up, sort of very different in nature. But I, you know, again, another father figure in literature that came up to me rather prominently when I first thought about this is, again, we don't have to discuss this at great length, especially since you can't stand the book. And we've talked, we've joked before on this podcast and off this podcast about this, basically this entire genre of fiction, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That you've got no time for and some other people in our family have no time for. And you and I, this is one of these books that you and I sort of vigorously disagree about in a congenial manner. But I think the book I'm about to mention is a great book. Of, you know, in the history of literature. This is one of the great novels in the history of literature, in my opinion.
Kind of hard to dispute that.
You don't really like it, although you don't really dispute its stature.
Correct.
You know, but also, you know, we've been talking, at least some of the stories we've been talking about, not all of them, because you just brought up Lear and stuff, but, you know, prominent in our own minds and in our own experiences, the relationship between fathers and sons. But obviously, it's not only about fathers and sons, and it's also about fathers and daughters. And both you and I have daughters. Now, I happen to have two of them, and you've got one.
Indeed.
But we have, you know, an ample taste of, like, the experience from the father's perspective of what it's like to be a father of a daughter. And to watch them grow up and all the different nuances that are associated with that relationship. You know, I remember for a long period there, of course, I had two daughters and you didn't have one. Or for, you know, a period of a number of years, I was like the daughter guy and you were like the son guy. Cause
definitely.
Your oldest three kids are sons. But then it was a source of great celebration for both of us that you got to get on the dad-daughter train and experience that with your youngest child.
And you got to get on the father-son train.
Right, when I had, so my older two children are both girls. Anyway, you know, the specific fatherly subject here is the relationship between fathers and daughters. And on that note, I could not get through this episode without bringing up the novel Pride and Prejudice. Because to me, you know, as a father of daughters, I might almost have to say, although it doesn't play a hugely prominent role in the story, but one of the towering dads of daughters specifically to me is Mr. Bennett, you know, Elizabeth Bennett's father in the novel Pride and Prejudice. So you don't really like the novel. We've talked about it before. You don't like novels of manners or like you really could give a shit, pardon my French, about any, you know, novel that has to do with English class, society or propriety or, you know, like whatever. So Jane Austen is just not really your thing. And I get it. You know, we've debated that before, but I do think Pride and Prejudice is one of the great novels in English. It's a magnificent book, from a literary perspective and from a story perspective and from a wisdom perspective and all these things. But one of the most prominent figures in the book is the father of the main character, Elizabeth Bennet, who, you know, has that very famous quote near the beginning of the book where Elizabeth Bennet, who's like one of his many daughters, but she's like the headstrong one, a little bit like Cordelia and Lear, who wants to marry for love and not be like wedded off to the first eligible bachelor that comes along, etc., etc. All that stuff that you have no time for. But there's that famous scene early in Pride and Prejudice where her mother, Elizabeth Bennet's mother in particular, is trying to get Elizabeth to align or match up with, the word match is so prominent in Jane Austen books, match up with this eligible bachelor who happens to be a preacher, like a minister, and, you know, Elizabeth Bennet's not into him, and she said, like, kind of, like, sort of made that clear to both of her parents, and he comes calling early in the novel, and he's, like, trying to impress her, whatever, and everybody's putting pressure on her to marry the guy, and then she has this side conversation with her dad in which he says, you know, well, Elizabeth, you know, I'm going to mangle the quote, but he's like, well, you now find yourself facing a dilemma. You know, of course, the minister has kind of like asked for her hand or whatever. And Mr. Bennet says to Elizabeth, you're now facing a dilemma because, you know, unfortunately, your poor mother is going to disown you if you marry Mr. What the heck is his name? Mr. Whatever, you know, like Mr. Preacher.
Who knows?
Your mother's going to disown you if you marry Mr. Preacher. And unfortunately, I am going to disown you if you do marry Mr. Preacher.
So the mother will disown you if you don't marry the preacher.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I mangled that. But your mother will disown you if you do not marry Mr. Preacher. Okay. I will disown you if you do marry Mr. Preacher. And that was the scene that spoke volumes about the relationship between the two of them.
That's
the understanding that the father has for Elizabeth Bennet and what her heart really desires. The alliance he makes in his own heart with her about wanting her to pursue what she wants to do. It's all in that. And that moment and that relationship is a pillar or a shadow or whatever behind the whole story. Elizabeth Bennet has essentially, in my opinion, the courage to be headstrong in a way, or the courage to stand by her own convictions. Because she has the love of her father and the support of her father.
Yep.
You know, so for me, I don't really have to go any further than that, because there's the whole tangled, you know, will they or won't they, you know, get married with Mr. Darcy and stuff like that. But the point is, she can be the strong, feminine woman, that character that she is so memorably in that story, not only because, she has her own virtues, but she feels supported by the literary father in the story. And she said, I have my, I have that, so I can be who I want to be. And that for me is a very almost moving, but like instructive example of what your daughters, when you're lucky enough to have daughters, really need from you, is to have the assurance of your, of your love and support.
You're saying it very well.
To be able to pursue what they want to pursue. So for me, that is an unmissable, I don't know what the word that I want, or, literary father for this episode. I just totally mangled that, but like that not be mentioned.
No, it's essential. Well,
yes, an essential example. Essential literary father in literature to me.
No, you may feel like you're stumbling around, but you made a great point, and you made it very well. Are you finished talking?
Yeah,
about that?
You know, you have a daughter, so
yeah, that
and he, you love Jane Austen so much.
I love Jane Austen. Loved Pride and Prejudice. I was actually going to argue he's the worst father of the list, because if he had just gotten everybody together,
for 5 minutes, they could have solved the problem.
You know? No, he's a
then you don't have an up.
That's right, and he's a Hall of Famer in terms of love for his children, specifically his daughters.
Yeah,
but a cellar dweller in terms of administration. But anyway, I get that's not the point. No, but seriously, he's one of the characters I did remember.
Yeah, and
obviously part of it is that I am a father and a male.
Right.
Although there are other male characters that you, remember and identify with. But I remember you're just like, this father has to, because doesn't he have like 3 daughters?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, so he's
3 or 4 daughters.
And a wife, so he's sort of wrangling.
Not 5. Is there 5?
I don't know, but there's a lot. And he's wrangling this kind of, and it's I'm far from saying he's in charge, because, in some ways,
he's like the bottom of the
barrel. Most surely is
like that,
But he is that steady presence, and for all the daughters, and the wife, and kind of comic, in the way he tries to like all of us do, all of us men do, we're bumbling to try to keep up with the women in our lives and understand what they're doing, but that part of that aspect of it is crucially important to the book. I'm not going to say it. You already said it. You said it very well, but that is a very strong argument for why any man or father would get something out of reading Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
I didn't love the book.
Right.
But I think your point is a very good one. And it's a great example.
Yeah. Thank you. And just as a side note, this is personal. Our listeners won't really know this, but I've always thought, and you're going to think I'm just kowtowing to the people that live in this house. But I'm telling you, maybe height aside, if you were to put Alex's father, Parks, in one of those silly suits from that period, and had him like walking in the moors with his hands behind his and saying that line, he was like that kind of man to me, because I didn't know him that well, but somebody who could, he had kind of a happy outlook. He was kind of carting a lot around a lot of wisdom. You could tell he had it. He didn't take things too seriously. And you could see him, like, kind of walking around and, like, you know, on the moors and saying that to one of his two, you know, beautiful daughters. You know,
yeah,
like, you know.
You could see that. Yeah, I get
that. I've always kind of thought that, even though it sounds like I'm just flattering the house here. But, you know, I think that kind of works. But anyway, our listeners don't know who Mr. Shipley was. But, So, like, you know, all of you dads that don't want to read, you know, Jane Austen because you're guys or whatever, you know. If you have daughters, maybe reconsider it and read that book. Suffer through it if you must, you know. But
it speaks to some of the deeper lessons sometimes that you pick up from great literature and books.
Yeah, like, yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah. 75. You know, like,
hope you all heard that.
That is a good point. But anyway, I want to go to a different book that's extremely different. There's no, like, through line here, except for the dads. But I happened to read this again. You and I talked when we were, like, in the early stages of this. And both of us, did you think of this on your own? Or did you think of it after I brought it up? You don't even know what book I'm
not sure what we're talking about.
The Paul Auster book.
Oh, yeah.
I think both of us thought.
Oh, I did think of it on my own.
Because we had both read it like 20 or 25 years ago or something like that.
It's on my list. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a writer both of us have sort of historically admired. We haven't read a lot of him recently. In fact, there's some books that he's written since I've been reading him that I'd like to catch up with. But one of the great American novelists working today, I think it's fair to say, is Paul Auster. Who has had several, you know, many decades of writing novels, primarily novels and some memoirs, but the New York trilogy we've brought up before, and like Music of Chance, which turned into a film, and many other novels, Mr. Vertigo, you know, Oracle Knight, like, you know, his books are usually set around New York City.
Yeah.
Usually have lots of mystery and twists and turns and ruminate on things like time, memory, chance, etc. But he's been working for decades. And even before he was a prominent novelist, he was a poet and a translator. Like, as far back as like the early 70s. So he's been at it for a long time.
Wow.
He could be a candidate for the Nobel Prize for Literature, maybe. You know, because he's still writing today. In fact, he has a new novel coming out, you know, which, wow, I didn't even realize. It was called Baumgartner. You know, so that, and it's a short novel, but he wrote a very big novel like probably 4 or 5 or 6 years ago that made a big splash because it was nominated for the National Book Award, called 4321, which I never read. I always thought that would be interesting to read because it's big. You know, but anyway, years ago in 1979, he published a memoir called The Invention of Solitude that was about fatherhood. And this is one of the few cases where I'll bring up the cover of the book because, like, you know, it's a kind of a weird book. It's like it's a short book. It's only like about 170 pages. Has two nonfiction books kind of bookended that are related but not the same book. So the first one is a very short memoir called A Portrait of the Invisible Man, which is about his father's death when around that time, was contemporary to that time. It was written like in the year after his father passed away, so Auster himself was a young man in like his 30s with a small son. So there's like a 60-page little brief memoir called Portrait of an Invisible Man about his relationship with his father and his father's death. It's mostly about his father. And then the second book is called The Book of Memory, and it's kind of written in the wake of the loss of his father, but it's about Auster's relationship with his small son at the time, Daniel, who's like 37 or 8 or something like that now. But like, and his grappling with being a father himself and kind of what that relationship means. You know, but in the first memoir called, The Portrait of the Invisible Man, it's a portrait of his father has recently died and he realizes that he'd never really connected with him or knew him. You know, as is implied in the title. And so when he dies, they're going through his personal effects and he's trying to find out and kind of who this man was. And one of the things that's mentioned is he finds this like old photo from like a Long Island, like amusement park trick photograph of his father as a young man, but something to do with shutters and lights or whatever. It's an actual photograph of his father dressed in a suit as a young person sitting at a table, but then the figure of the father is duplicated 5 times around the same table.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's a brilliantly used ad for the cover of the book. And he ruminates on that in a very kind of poetic and interesting way about how, you know, there's five guys that look like his dad around the table. They're all a mystery. Like, he doesn't know anything about any one of them. They're all ciphers, wow. You know. And in that book in particular, I won't go on too much more about this book. The portrait of the second book, The Book of Memory, was very interesting and moving, just from the point of view of having a small child and trying to be more prominent and memorable and responsible figure in that boy's life that you didn't have with your father. But the first book is about how his father was always unreachable to him as a child growing up, and mm-hmm. he was like focused, you know, it was kind of like our grandfather, what we know of our grandfather who we never met, you know, known for his business, focused on work, kind of went off in the morning to work and was like, you know, known in the community and like, you know, everybody knew who he was and would come back home and was kind of like a cipher, didn't express himself emotionally, never really connected with, you know, Paul Auster, who was his oldest son, and was kind of unreachable. But what comes out in that short memoir is that after he died and they're going through his effects, he uncovers this, like, story about his father's father who was murdered by his wife. So his grandfather was murdered by his grandmother, you know, and he begins wow. to piece together the story of what happened there as a means of explaining why his father was so unreachable, you know, and just couldn't, like, because his father was a small child when his grandmother shot his grandfather in the kitchen because he was such an emotionally abusive man who, like, was just didn't treat her well. And the effects of that on Auster's father is what is it suggested. That's what made him into this unreachable, invisible man. So that's all I'll really say about that. A very fascinating book, a very interesting book to read. And there's a lot of, like, interesting and poetic prose on time and memory and, you know, just fatherhood. But, like, it's a kind of a fascinating story. What do you remember about the invention of solitude?
Very little. Yeah. Like, that's what, I read it so long ago that
I remember that photo, though.
Like, I remember the photo.
Yeah.
I don't remember most of what you just said. But yeah.
I didn't either.
Including that, you know, that there's a section about his own father and then there's a second section about him being a father.
Yeah.
But the whole thing is a rumination on kind of the vocation of fatherhood, you know.
Yeah, and that role. What it's like when somebody's playing it for you and what it's like when you have to play it for others.
Yeah, I'm not sure Paul Auster would use the word vocation, but he might. He might use words that you've used, like cipher and role and mystery.
He's not a religious person.
No, not at all. But very interesting writer.
Yeah.
And there are lots of ciphers and invisible people and ghosts in his his body of work.
Yeah, yeah. This goes some distance towards explaining why that those presences or absences are there.
Yeah.
You know, in his stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He often writes about being haunted in one way or another. Yeah. And not literally, like, by a ghost, but figuratively by a presence or an absence.
One of his novels is called Ghosts.
Okay, well, there you go. But we can't solve this, but it's just interesting to note that his book on fatherhood is a very curious and interesting title, The Invention of Solitude.
Right, right.
Because it begs a lot of questions, like, is the father inventing the solitude, or is the role of father, is that the invention of solitude?
Right.
Or, like, what is that exactly? And you don't think necessarily of fatherhood as a solitary endeavor.
You don't.
But it seems to speak to, and we've touched on this already, and we probably will touch on it again, but, like, in many ways, children, they try to fully grasp and understand their own fathers and never quite get there. I would even say, even in the best of relationships, you can't fully understand.
No.
But I guess you could say that about any relationship. You know, you can't 100% understand another soul. But certainly, most of us, throughout our entire lives, we strive to understand who your parents really were.
Yeah, what they thought. Parental role, what they felt. Really want to know.
And
to discover it.
You don't totally get there. I know
There's a lot I know and remember and love about our dad, but fully understand him? No.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are two more really great picks.
I'm going to take a quick pause here for just a second, and for the listeners, it'll be seamless.
All right, so anyway, back here, and those were two more books I wanted to bring up. What else do you have on your list?
I have a couple pairings that I'll try to go through fast, because I'm looking at my list and trying to consolidate it. There's one more book I'd like us to discuss.
Okay.
You know,
and I have a pairing that I want to hit, too.
Not necessarily at length. So, and then there's a few more titles I could just throw out. But I have two pairings. The first one is two books that I read that came to mind as, like, really, you know, might be great choices for this episode. One of them, I think, really does fit in. One of them doesn't fit in as well as I thought it would. So, but very famous memoir by a writer that we've mentioned several times on this podcast and who we both really love. And he's just, I was reminded again, I read this memoir for the first time. I've read a lot of his work, but I never read this book, which is arguably his most famous. But we both love the writer Tobias Wolff. Mm. He's an incredible short story writer.
Right.
But probably his most well-known book, if you're going to know any book by him by name, it might be This Boy's Life, which is his memoir about growing up. Because it was made into a film starring DiCaprio and De Niro. But it's just, it's a book about his upbringing, which had a lot of turmoil and a lot of things happen. But my impression of it was that it was mainly about his difficult relationship with a sort of stepfather. So it's, you know, lots of stepfathers in literature and books as well.
Yeah.
And this is one of the ones. But that was not quite as, it didn't dominate the book. It wasn't the most important, it wasn't, it's an important through line in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But the book is really, and you and I talked about this off camera, you know, the book is really mostly about how he sort of invented and sort of reinvented himself.
Yes.
You know, as a teenager and his sort of development. It doesn't even touch on his writing life that much. Just kind of.
No.
He didn't have a really solid identity because his biological father left the family early on. His mother. He wasn't the best father figure either, his biological father, and he was a drinker, and his mother put Tobias Wolff in a car and left and drove across country from Florida to Utah. Although most of the book takes place, he did a lot of growing up in the Seattle area. But point is, his mother put him in a car and they drove away. And eventually she gets married, she meets and then later marries a guy named Dwight who becomes his stepfather. And he's just a not a very good father all around. And, you know, so while the story, there's a lot in the book about basically what a poor father figure this guy Dwight was. He was abusive. He had sort of these crazy views. He would really belittle Tobias Wolff as a youngster. And then eventually his mother sort of escapes out from under him and then, you know, leaves and goes somewhere else. So Tobias Wolff did a lot of moving around as a kid, but certainly the influence of this guy Dwight, the negative influence, was a prominent one in the book. Not quite as prominent as I thought it would be. And eventually he comes up with a scheme to kind of basically con his way into being accepted into an elite private high school on the East Coast.
Right.
Which he had no business being in. And he says that. He says, like, you know, he basically lied, cheated, and stole in order to get into this. He conned the whole board. He, like, got himself into this school.
Wrote letters and stuff.
Yeah, he forged letters and recommendations, and he just did this whole thing. And then he gets in. He's like, I had no business being there. That was borne out. You know, I basically got, you know, in a figurative sense, he got taken behind the woodshed and got the, you know, bejesus kicked out of him academically. He did not do well there. Nor socially did he fit in, but he said, eventually he goes, you know, I was, because his one thing that he really enjoyed growing up was scouting. He said, eventually I ended up joining the army, which is where I belonged all along, but you should be careful what you pray for, because he immediately goes to Vietnam. And that's another book he wrote about his experience in Vietnam called In Pharaoh's Army, I think.
Pharaoh's Army.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, just a really interesting, it's an interesting book and an interesting example of the negative influence of a step parent who just really had no business being a parent at all. But it's very well written, like any Tobias Wolff book. But that was one that I read that I thought would be perfect for this list. Nah, not so much. You know, it's worth mentioning, but not maybe a perfect fit.
Yeah, it has a strange, you know, quality of, you said earlier that it's like they're not really, I agree that it's not so much about fatherhood as you might think, or like father figures as you might think. It's really more about the individual who wrote it.
Right.
But also, you said it's not really about writing, just an interesting side note about it, except by implication, almost.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the whole story speaks to because you come into it knowing that he's a successful fiction writer, and the way that he got, part of the way he got to be, to have the chops to be a successful fiction writer is because he had invented himself in a fictional way. You know, like,
yeah.
He was skilled at self-invention, which is one of the things that the book suggests, like, made it possible for him to be, invent other selves, you know, like a mere fiction writer. But anyway,
and also that's like off that topic. That self-invention is part of what kind of helped him get out from under,
yes,
the negative influence and shadow of this just very abusive and just not a very good guy, this guy Dwight.
Yeah, so, and you could argue that, like, even though he was not successful at the school, it was still a successful endeavor conning his way into the school because it led him to who he became later.
Yeah. Anyway. In many ways, the point we've been making about the influence of fathers and father figures is made by that book as well, because his biological father kind of swims back into the memoir towards the end.
Mm.
And, you know,
remember that.
That's not the best relationship either, you know. So sometimes when you don't have a solid father figure, your life is characterized by the search for one, you know.
Well, that's going to come up in some of the books I mentioned.
But okay. So that was one book that I read for this list. The other book that I read, I actually reread. I'd read it once before, which I do want to say right out of the gate is a very high recommendation. And I know it's a book we've talked about a lot, but you've never read it, and it's called Tinkers. It's a novel called Tinkers by a guy named Paul Harding, who has a really interesting story because he's basically the drummer of a rock band, like an indie rock band. I don't know if you remember that.
Now that you mention it, I do.
But he kind of wrote on the side, and, you know, it was just sort of a hobby for him.
What was the band?
I can't remember. Well, anyway, something from Massachusetts.
I would remember it if I heard the name.
Yeah. But, you know, fairly successful there, but he wrote on the side, which nobody really realized, and then he had written an entire novel, Tinkers, and he had a very hard time getting any publishers to take a chance on it.
Oh, wow. That's
It was finally picked up by a very small press called Bellevue Literary Press or something, or Bayview. Very small. Very quickly wins the Pulitzer Prize. And just, it was one of these stories. He was like a literary wunderkind. He just emerged overnight.
Yeah, well, he went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, too.
Well, true. So he had talent. So he got into that very famous writers' program. And I don't remember who now, but I know he studied under some really... Oh, Mary Lynn Robinson.
Okay, that makes sense.
And she has a really interesting blurb on the back of the book, which I actually wanted to read because it's going to be hard to describe. Well, I'll kind of briefly describe it, but I want to read what Mary Lynn Robinson said about it because, as usual with Mary Lynn Robinson, who hasn't come up that much in this podcast, but she's just a phenomenal writer. Very acute sensibility and insight.
Intellectual.
Yeah, she's amazing. But the reason why I wanted to bring it up is because the story it's very interesting the way it's written. And I'm going to say this all like, you got to read this book. You got to get around this book, dude.
Yeah. So I have a copy of it. I think you bought for me.
Yeah, you got to get to it one day because it's a man on his deathbed. And it's the last 7 days of his life. The whole book is. It's a short book. I'm holding it up in front. It's about 170 pages. Reads quickly. But the whole story is the last 7 days of his life. His family is gathered around him, you know, just like people in our family, like our uncle and other, you know, the hospital bed has been taken into the house and it's a hospice kind of situation.
Yeah.
And they're holding vigil around him. His children and their children, his one sister who's still alive. But The whole book is he's having memories of his father. He's flashing back to who his father was across these 7 days. So it's split up into these different passages, or some of the passages are him kind of, and it's really vividly rendered. You almost don't know how Harding did it, because the description of someone who's about to die and feels in his final hours and feels his end of his life rapidly approaching, and his mind and memory are gone. So he's describing kind of what he sees these people around him, what he's seeing. He sees the people gathered for a meal. He sees people sort of holding vigil around him, and he's like, and his grandson is sitting there with him, and he's like, I don't know who this guy is, but he's been nice enough to sit here with me. It's like a feat of literary magic for how he was able to describe this state, not having been in it.
Yeah, it's sort of like that scene in Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
At the end of the movie, showing all this shock and shock from having just been through this terrible ordeal when he wasn't actually...
Exactly.
He didn't actually go through the terrible ordeal.
Yeah, how did he do that?
Yeah.
And the same thing, how Harding described this state of mind, I don't know, but those parts are incredible. But then... Yeah,
I can see why that would be impressive.
Sure. There are several layers to this book. There are other... You know, then he's giving you pieces of the life of of the dying man's father, who made his living with this old horse and cart, and he was like a tinker. He had like different parts and like products that he sold, and he walked from farm to farm.
Okay.
It was just like he would visit like twice a year, because there it took a long time to get to like after the, and it's in like northern Massachusetts or something. So like once the winter thaws happened, he'd come and help them resupply.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also, I can't remember him or the dying man, but he was interested in repairing old clocks. So there are these passages that describe in incredible detail the inner workings of clocks.
Oh, okay.
And they're incredibly, it's hard to describe this way, but they're really poetic, and you can sense that they're rich with like metaphorical meaning, but they're very detailed, and they tell you about the inner workings of all these different clocks and what they can do. And it's just like, it's just this unique mix of different passages, you know, that somehow come together and create this really fascinating portrait of like mortality, you know, and one father's relationship to another. And what we were talking about before, like, you know, the dying man is many of his final thoughts are about his dad, trying to figure out who the father was. And the other piece, important piece I haven't mentioned yet, is that the father, the dying man's father was an epileptic. So he has these epileptic seizures that the boy is seeing as a young kid and trying to understand what these are. And those are incredibly rendered. So it's this very interesting mix of, I mean, it doesn't sound, it's hard to make it sound interesting, but it's one of the most unique combinations in a book. So
it's sort of a heady brew of things.
Yeah, but the writing is magnificent. And sometimes it really reminded me of McCarthy. Like, it's that level.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the descriptions.
Which is fraught enterprise, because you can seem like you're just a knockoff, like he did with Faulkner.
Yeah. But I wanted to, like, I'll give you just a brief taste of it, because I have a passage here, and he's describing the old man, the man who's the tinker, you know, who walks a lot through the woods to walk from farm to farm, but he's also
dying man's father.
Right, but he's also an epileptic. So there's like, there's this vague kind of like brain imagery in this short passage. But this is the kind of writing that he does. He's talking about, he's walking through the woods and the sun's going down. It sank into the stand of beech trees beyond the back lot, lighting their tops so that their bare arterial branches turned to a netting of black vessels around brains made of light. The trees lolled under the weight of those luminescent organs growing at the tops of their slender trunks. The brains murmured among themselves. They kept counsel and possessed a wintry wisdom. Cold scarlet and opaline minds, brief and burnished, flaring in the metallic blue of dusk. That's the level of writing. And
that's what's so weird is that I picked up this book at random this morning from your table and opened it, maybe because it has the dog ear. I read that same passage this morning. I was like, that's crazy.
It's just very poetic.
The brains murmured together in the light.
But you don't get the context just hearing that, but it's like...
No.
Epilepsy.
But it's striking.
Epilepsy runs through the book. So there's these brain storms.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's fascinating, but...
But it's striking even if you don't know that, you know.
Yeah, this is what Marilynne Robinson said about the book, by the way. So just that by way of conclusion and also selling it to you maybe a little bit more. She says, Tinkers is truly remarkable. It achieves and sustains a unique fusion of language and perception. Its fine touch plays over the textured richnesses of very modest lives, evoking again and again a frisson of deep recognition, a sense of primal encounter with the brilliant, elusive world of the senses. It confers on the reader the best privilege fiction can afford, the illusion of ghostly proximity to other human souls.
First of all, that's an
incredible quote.
It's a good piece of writing by itself. You know,
like, that sells this book, at least to you, me speaking to you, better than
I
could.
Yeah, is that what this is? You selling the book to me?
Essentially.
You know, like,
yeah.
Well, I have it. You're doing a good job, by the way. Like, because I never, you know, really pulled it off the shelf.
Tinkers is fascinating. And again, to wrap it up, like, we talked earlier about, like, you read something that's not quite like anything you've ever read before.
Yeah.
The combination of elements here is something I can't think of another example or analogy for.
Yeah.
So I'll just, if that doesn't intrigue you, I don't know what would.
Well, that's a great one. And on that note, so we don't have a lot of time left. We only have like really about 15 minutes.
Right.
I had at least three other books on my list.
I'm
not going to go through them at length. There's two that I want to mention. I said I had a pairing I want to mention, which I will mention. However, I do think if I can, you know, reflect on our own performance here so far, I think we've managed to touch on some very well-known works, dads in literature, and some more obscure dads in literature pretty well up to now. So I'm going to talk a little bit about two other books I wanted to mention, and then I'm going to mention a third that I at least wanted to bring up that I'm not going to talk about at length. Then I'll kick it over. You cover them like maybe the last ones on your list.
Okay.
But I do want to bring up a pairing right now, you know, starting to do that. And, you know, we'll just keep our eye on the clock here. Try not to go too far over 2 hours because we also have to discuss what we're going to read and briefly tease episode 57. But, But there's a genre we have not spoken about very much. Well, we have a little bit, but that I wanted to bring up because two books from this particular genre really stand out to me. We had an episode a long while back, one of our most popular episodes from the first 56 episodes, by the way, was our episode on music. And we talked a lot about certain musicians' memoirs in that one. I want to bring up the memoirs of two very famous musicians that I've read over the last 5 or 6 years, briefly, in the vein of literary fathers. So this is like fathers in literature, but nonfiction, specifically about music or popular artists and their rise to fame or who they became.
I know where this is going.
Yeah, the first one is Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, which, by the way, I'll just plug our episode, I want to say 32 or 3.
33, because we call it 33 and 3rd.
33 and 3rd, thank you.
Yeah.
In which I talked at length about my love for Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, the book, as a work of literature. And then I'm going to pair that with a book I've read much more recently, which was called Surrender by Bono, who's the lead singer of U2, as everybody who's not living under a rock knows. All I want to say about I highly recommend both books, including Surrender, which you haven't read and you weren't as high on reading for various reasons.
I think it would be interesting, actually.
But I was really struck when we decided on this topic how both of those books came to my mind because of the absence of the fathers of these two very famous, very, very, very famous men.
World famous
entertainers and singers. Lyricists, writers, activists, wildly successful people that both of these men came from very understated, borderline impoverished backgrounds in both the United States and Bruce Springsteen's case, New Jersey, famously, and Bono in Dublin, but in a really impoverished area of Dublin. I want to recommend both their memoirs, just as a general thing. And one of the most fascinating aspects to me, being like a son and a father myself, was the massive presence of the absence, in a way, of their fathers to them and how that informed their journey towards this massive level of success. Like, I knew that Bruce Springsteen's book, because Bruce Springsteen's troubled relationship with his dad for most of his youth is pretty famous, pretty widely known. It's in this famous song, Independence Day, other songs. You know, he, and it's like the Paul Auster father figure. Like, he, they couldn't, and our dad and his father, they couldn't connect with you. They didn't understand each other. And I was surprised by how much Bono's book discusses how much he couldn't really connect well with his father, even though his father was in many ways a musician. He was an opera singer. But they, that their life was marked by the death, the early death of Bono's mother, who, that event left his father kind of moreless and, you know, kind of not sure where to go with his life or with his affections or whatever. And Bono describes very emotionally, very movingly, how he grew up in this house in Dublin with himself, his father, and his brother, and they just were all... He said they effectively, not only did they forget his mother, but they just eliminated her from existence entirely by never bringing her up again. So it's like she just became like this non-figure until Bono sort of confronted her in his life later. But the he couldn't connect with his father, and there was a lot of clashing, the book implies. And then I happened to see Bono's stage performance, which is based on his memoir, and his father plays a prominent role in that show. He does these like monologues with an empty chair. And it had a great amount to do with his father, whose name was... it's Hewson. Anyway, Bono's nickname is Paul Hewson in real life, and his father's name was Hewson. I can't remember his father's first name, which is... Anyway. But I won't go long about those books, because there's a lot of... It's just very fascinating how later in their lives, writing these memoirs, revisiting the relationship that they did or did not have with their fathers, and then in both books there's... Both artists arrive at, I think, kind of a certain level of wisdom and an understanding of who their fathers were and why they could not connect with their sons. And there's a great deal of compassion and forgiveness for both of these father figures in the book, even though they essentially were not there for Bruce or Bono when they needed them. There's like a level of compassion and forgiveness that comes across in both books that's very fascinating, and they sort of like are able to see why it was difficult for their fathers to be good fathers, essentially. So I'll leave it there. You've read Born to Run, you have Rent Surrender. I don't know if you want to say anything about that. Then there's one other book I wanted to mention, but I just can mention it in passing.
Only in the interest of time. I mean, we did talk about Born to Run, which is the one that I have read.
Right.
And I'm sure I made some comments there. So only in the interest of time, I'll just say, I mean, they're both, I think they're, both of those books deserve to be discussed here. And I do think the Bono one would be quite interesting. The interesting thing about those two, juxtaposing those two together, is that Bruce did end up having this mother figure who was a huge part of his formation life, and Bono did not at all.
That's a huge point of contrast there. Big difference.
And I'm sure those guys are buddies, right? At least seems like it. So I'm sure you probably talked about that before.
Yes.
But let's, just in the interest of time, because we've already talked about Born to Run, and I can't say much about Surrender not having read it, what was the other book you wanted to bring up?
Well, actually, I'll call an audible. I'll just drop that one, because it's like a different book entirely. But
do you want to at least mention it?
Well, I can, like, you know, with it, like, so the other book I was going to bring up is a book you gave me, a nonfiction book called The Black Count.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Which is a story about this historian basically went back and put together the life story, or essentially a biography of the father of Alexandre Dumas, who went on to write The Three Musketeers, Count of Monte Cristo, and it explores how influential Dumas's father was to him, and Dumas's father was a mixed race, and he became a general in the French army, in spite of his mixed race, black and white.
And Haiti, right? Haiti?
Haiti, yes. Yeah. And he lived this prominent, adventurous, swashbuckling type of life where he led many men through many campaigns in the Italian Alps and other places in the world. He was a prisoner in the Mediterranean for like 15 or 16 years. And the book explores his father's life and how the esteem that Alexandre Dumas and the almost worship he had of his father, who was gone a lot, and how that informed the great fiction that everybody knows. So the book's called The Black Count, won the Pulitzer Prize. It's a kind of a combination of almost swashbuckling true life fiction story, historical nonfiction stories, and biography. Worth checking out.
And that his father's story was a direct and prominent influence on maybe his best known novel, which is The Count of Monte Cristo.
Count of Monte Cristo, yes. Like I said, almost like a biographical work of fiction about his own dad, which most people don't realize.
Right. Well, this is why I gave this book to you, first of all, because that story you just described about his life and the influence of the father, who was of mixed race and was a... A, that sounds incredible and fascinating. B, yeah. I've never actually read The Count of Monte Cristo.
I haven't either.
I've seen at least one movie adaptation, and the story's awesome, so I'd love to read that someday. Gosh, I mean... Yeah, we have to wrap up. There's a number of books I would have liked to have discussed and recommend. For example, regardless of where you stand politically, Barack Obama's book about literally sort of searching for who his father was, mm-hmm. is called Dreams of My Father.
Yeah.
And his father, as just about every American knows or should know, his mother was a white woman, Caucasian, from Kansas, kind of the middle of nowhere in America. His father's from Kenya. And they met, I believe they met in California, his parents. But anyway, that combination, you know, it's fascinating that they gave birth to somebody who would become president of the United States. But this book
highly improbable.
Highly, unbelievably improbable. Yeah. But this book was written well before he became president. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to read on that level because you're reading it and going, well, this is a man who would later become president of the United States.
Against every odd imagine.
But... the book is a very personal one about his search, not physically to know where his father was, but to know who his father was. He goes back to Kenya. And it's also, I was almost a little disappointed that it's mixed in a little bit with a kind of a political memoir, or like at least a story. Disappointed maybe isn't the right word, but I found those parts a little less interesting about the path that led him to be going to politics and end up in Chicago, which is where he made a name for himself. He writes very movingly and directly about just trying to figure out who his father was. And it's interesting read on many levels.
Yeah.
Certainly thematically with what we're talking about and this absence. Yeah. Like he had only met or been with his father once or twice his entire life. Mm-hmm. He didn't know him. Mm-hmm. So this book was all about his search to kind of understand who he was. And how, you know, that might impact the man that Barack Obama would become.
And during much of the search, was his father dead or was his father absent?
Both, but I don't remember the percentage.
Okay.
I just don't remember. But I think for a lot of it, he was dead. He was trying to... But anyway, it's very interesting. Worth reading, for sure.
I would certainly read it, yeah.
Another one, a popular book that came out that many, many people read several years ago was called H is for Hawk. And most people think, oh, that's the book about a woman who tries to raise hawks and figure out how, you know, just like form a bond with a hawk, which is true. But the whole thing was kicked off by her grief from losing her father. So she weaves in her father's influence on her and, everything she's learning about the hawk is kind of colored by her relationship with her dad, who kind of inspired her imagination and who she misses very much. And so, like, it's very much a memoir about the loss of a father as much as it is about this hawk. And it's beautifully written. And there's a reason it's as well known as it is.
Yeah, another good... And the father-daughter relationship again, you know.
Exactly, yeah. I was going to go down this whole path. I just don't have time. But like the prodigal son story from the Bible, like we could, I mean, that in itself is worth bringing up in this discussion.
Absolutely.
But a writer you love a lot named Ron Hansen wrote a novel.
Yeah.
And the name of this novel, curiously, has already come up, but the novel's called Atticus.
Yes.
Which is no accident, I'm sure. But he wrote a kind of a modern retelling of the story of the prodigal son in a way.
Yeah, not even kind of. Like, it's just, you know, it's a very reminiscent of that story.
It is, on purpose. I mean,
in some ways, yeah.
Ron Hansen is a Catholic writer that we've talked about before. But, and I read it so long ago, I hardly remember it. But it's a story, it's also a story of a father's grief, you know, because his son has been murdered in Mexico. And he's trying to, he travels to Mexico to try to find out what exactly happened and recover his body and bring it back. It's been so long since I read it, but that's actually, I really want to reread that one.
That'd be a great reread,
But I can, even though it's been so long, I would recommend it because of those elements. Retelling of the Prodigal Son, Ron Hansen, the writer we love. So I'm going to bring up one more pairing really quick, and then another one that we have to at least mention. The pairing, you know what? I'll call it audible too. We just don't have time. There are two books that are about fathers losing children that both of them punched me so hard in the stomach and are very, very moving. One's nonfiction, one is fiction. The fiction one I know you have read, and it's by a writer, this is on the obscure side, not well remembered.
I know where you go.
It's by a writer named Peter DeVries. It's called The Blood of the Lamb.
Yeah.
And it's a novel about a father who's losing his young daughter to a blood cancer.
Yes.
Just devastating book.
It's a tough one.
It's just a novel about a father going through that process and the long kind of slow death of his daughter and his wrestling with God and faith.
Yeah, well, the title implies, you know, the blood of the lamb.
It's like, if you can stomach that kind of material, it's a very moving, and I think you're like this too, but I love stories and books that are about the wrestling with God and the deeper meaning of life.
Yes. Yeah.
This is a really moving book. In that vein. And there's a non-fiction memoir, very famous, called Death Be Not Proud by a man named John Gunther. And it's all about losing his son, his young son, to some kind of, I think it might be bone cancer or some kind of cancer. And it's just about, you know, wrestling with being a father and being in that position of watching a son slowly die, which we have at least one friend who's gone through this. Named Roger, who's gone through this process of losing a young child to an incurable disease.
Yes,
Both of these books are just unbelievable gut punches, but they're both beautiful and they're in a sad way. I thought I would mention that. Last thing,
have you read that?
I have. Oh, yeah, I just pulled it off the shelf behind you here because I wanted to make sure I remembered the name of the writer. If you don't mind, you didn't have anything else you were going to bring up, were you?
No, I'm done.
But we can't spend a lot of time on this, but we cannot do this episode without mentioning The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
So, most people who know, we already did a whole episode about Cormac McCarthy, we mentioned The Road, but that's the whole thing about that book. It's a father and son traveling through this wasteland because it's after some kind of apocalyptic or nuclear event.
Right, and then the boy's mother was killed.
Yeah, and it's just, was she killed or did she kill herself? It's kind of, but anyway, the mother kind of lost hope, and the father, his whole hope was invested in the son and keeping the son alive.
Yeah.
And the whole story is just about that, about them traveling to what he hopes is a safer place, and he's just literally, his entire focus is to keep his son safe.
Yeah.
And alive. And it's kind of like it plays like a parable almost, just or a, I don't know, like a, it's just kind of a meditation.
A little like Jean Valjean in that way, like his whole, you know,
but it
focuses to remain true to, you know, his bond with the child, you know.
It's somber, it's beautifully written, has a perfect ending.
Yeah, has a
It has a tragic ending, but then the very, very end strikes a beautiful chord.
Yeah,
that is really you just have to read it to. But
yeah,
but you can't read it unless you read everything that
No. It's like the payoff, and it's one of the best.
Got to be one of the most beautiful endings of any book.
It's one of the best last paragraphs I've ever read, for sure. You know, like, no question.
So, I don't know. Do you have anything, a quick comment you want to make on the road? Like,
no, I mean,
other
I,
than read it?
I read it a couple times. Yeah, people should read it. It's like, you know, like, it's one of the, it's kind of an essential Cormac McCarthy book, for sure, but like, you know, I would almost call it an essential novel on fatherhood also, just like, you know, like, and it's just a, it's a, such an incredible, like, literary performance from top to bottom, you know.
Yeah, I guess, like, as corny as it may sound, and he himself said once in a rare interview, he's like, it sounds corny or whatever, but it's like, you're not going to find, I can't think of a more, of a better example of a book that just describes and kind of radiates a father's love for their young son than that one.
Right.
Both in action and in at some point in words.
Yeah, remember how they bounded over the phrase carrying the fire, the son, the young son asked it,
yeah, you know,
are we carrying the fire? And the father's like, yeah, we're carrying the fire.
Right. And you know, that like has so many symbolic resonances.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's a great book. That's a good one to close it on. So why don't we talk, I'm going to ask you to mention what you're going to read next, if you can or want to, because I'm going to do mine as a way to lead into the tease for the next episode.
Okay.
Unless it's the same.
It is. It probably is the same. So.
Okay. So why don't you, why don't we just do it all of a piece since we're running along anyway.
Fine.
So we're going to talk about the next book we're going to read, which happens to be, at least, I don't know if it's going to be the immediate next book for both of us, but we're both planning to read this book coming up soon because of our next episode. Take it away.
And the book is Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, an American classic. Neither of us have ever read it.
Never.
I mean, I mentioned this to you like years ago, the Modern Library put out a list of the best 100 American novels of all time. And I believe Catch 22 was like 7 or 8. And I saw that again recently. And we had talked about, well, I guess I'm stealing your thunder, but.
No.
I mean, we had talked about doing another episode on a single book and maybe doing one on a classic.
Yeah. An older book.
An older book. Like an acknowledged classic that maybe we hadn't, at least one of us haven't read. And we kind of realized that neither of us have read this book that's in the top 10, at least according to one list, of American books of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, you know, that I personally have had this book on my shelf for at least 25 years.
See, I don't even have it.
Yeah. I bought it used years ago thinking, well, I got to read that book. But that's like 25 years ago. I have to read that book sometime. It's been sitting there the whole time. It's a beat up paperback version of this book, but it's one of these things that's become so, obviously it's become so much a part of our culture that everybody knows the term Catch 22.
Right.
I use it all the time. I really have no idea what the book is about, except I know it's like a comedic book set in like World War II.
I was literally just going to ask you
anything else.
I was going to cut you off and say, actually, let's do this. Tell me what you know about the book.
I know it's a comedy set in World War II. That's all I know. And that the title became a term that means when you're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. That's all I don't even know if I'm going to understand why the title applies to the story when I read it, you know.
Well, I'm laughing to say I knew even less than you did because I did not know it was a comedy.
I think it's a comedy, isn't it? we don't know.
People who read it are probably laughing, but I would venture to say it's a very famous book, but I certainly have never heard anybody talk about it, so I think it's like not as prominent anymore.
Yeah, but like Joseph Heller, like so when we were kids and forming our literary imagination, Joseph Heller was a big name because he was one of these people like I can't think of any, of course, who like makes a big, big literary splash with their first book. And then every other, kind of like a John Irving type, not necessarily the first book, but every book that comes out after it was a big event because he was the guy that wrote Catch 22. So Joseph Heller was publishing novels steadily through the 70s and 80s when we were kids. Remember parents had that.
What was that book?
It was called, don't remember. Something about God or
something about God.
Yeah. I can't remember it right now, but
you remember the cover though?
Yeah, with like the comic cloud balloon shouting out of the speech balloon coming out of a cloud. And what did it say? Like, you know, it
said go figure.
Go figure. Yeah. Or was that called Something Happened? Another book by, I don't remember. But Joseph Heller, he published another book called Something Happened, and he published it. He was a guy who was publishing when we were growing up because he was so famous for Catch-22.
Right.
You know.
So anyway, our next episode should be interesting because you're taking on a book that neither one of us have any experience with whatsoever and just kind of going in blind, and we're both going to read it, and then we're going to meet, and we're going to react to it.
Yeah. And we're going to... I imagine that it's going to be like trying to figure out what the heck is so the book was so famous for in the first place, or like what is the deal with this book? I'm not totally sure I will even understand it, especially because of how dated it is now.
Yeah,
but I have no idea. So we're going to find out. We're going to try to figure it out in the next episode.
And it's sort of interesting that we've already done an episode of World War II books because I know it came up. It was probably mentioned, but we're both like,
we knew so little about it that we couldn't even go there.
You know? So this is like kind of spiritually linked to that episode.
Yeah.
So. But that's what we're going to do. Just a total curveball. And so that's kind of what we're both going to be reading next in one way or another.
That's right. And then episode 57, we'll be doing one of our BXC reviews episode on Catch-22. So... that's going to do it for this episode on Literary Fathers in Literature, John. I think we left a lot on the table, but we certainly covered a lot. So, and I appreciate the use of your home and your family who's been indulging us to record this episode. And we hope you all enjoyed it. Happy belated Father's Day to all the dads out there. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening from Maryland. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.